Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and can be more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Visit betterhelp.com/radiolab today to get 10% off your first month.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, this is Jad. Just a heads up that this first segment of our show today deals with animal reproduction and evolution, and it contains a couple of references to male sexual organs. If you're listening with young kids or you're just not in the mood, you might want to sit this one out.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
Whose pad is this?
Oh, I think that's mine.
Oh my gosh, Bethel, your handwriting.
My handwriting is awful.
Your handwriting is not awful. It's actually very elegant.
Is it?
Legible, not so much.
It's not
but
legible.
But elegant, though.
Jad here, this is Radiolab. So not too long ago, Robert and our producer, Bethel Hopte,
has a nice lean to it.
Pulled me into the studio to walk me through this story that they'd been working on together for quite some time.
Everybody hears everybody?
Yes.
Yeah.
Here we are.
All right. So shall we start this?
Yes. So what are we doing?
You guys are just going to tell me the story, or should
I? I'd rather tell you a riddle.
Okay.
Once upon a time, birds evolved. They evolved from dinosaurs. So there was originally scaly things, and the scales turned into feathers, and the feathery things began to fly, and we call those things birds.
Mm-hmm.
But they have I'm going to just ask this to you out of the blue, because it's a basic appendage. How many birds have penises?
Oh, okay.
And by the way, before you answer, there are like 10 to 20,000 different kinds of birds by modern times. So again, how many of those species have penises?
What percentage of currently existing birds?
Modern bird species have
male ones, obviously.
The males, of course. Yeah.
With penises as we would identify?
Yeah, like
okay,
little things that
right.
Hang out.
No, yeah, we don't have to talk.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, those things.
Yeah, I don't know.
This is making you
so awkward. You know, making this draft, I was saying the word penis like so many times.
At one point she wrote on the page, do you know how many times we said penises? And I read 27 in 4 minutes.
Okay, yes. So how many birds have penises?
Well, I have absolutely no frame of reference to answer this question. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to throw out a number, 40%.
No.
No, 70%. Let's say 70.
No.
30.
Lower.
10?
Lower.
Wow. 5?
Lower.
1?
3.
3?
3%.
Yeah, 97% of birds don't have penises.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we learned this little fact from a scientist named Patty Brennan.
The thing that's so weird about birds is precisely the fact that they lost the penis.
Well, you just said, you just used an interesting verb. So that you say the birds lost the penises. So does that mean that earlier editions of birds did have them?
That's right, yeah. So penises are widespread trait of all vertebrates, right? Except for, you know, some amphibians and fish.
And according to Patty, if you go back 200 million years or so, birds were like all those other creatures.
Yeah, like basically 100% of them had penises.
Exactly right.
But over time, in the vast, vast majority of birds,
the penis was then lost.
Now,
Why would that be?
Well, that's the question.
How do you lose a penis? Like, it seems like a pretty handy thing to have when you want to put your sperm close to female eggs.
So the 97% of birds that don't have a penis now, what do they have?
Well, they have a kind of hole. Both birds, the male and the females, have these holes, and they sort of open up, and then they line them up.
Yeah, it's called a cloaca.
Oh, they have a cloaca.
They have this cloaca, and they just briefly touch their cloaca when they're mating, and that's it. That's it.
And it works just fine. But if you're thinking about the engineering, like what appendage is going to work best for you to make babies, penis is the one.
Because it gets your sperm closer to female eggs.
Oh.
So for all of these penises to just vanish, like she says that evolutionarily, that just doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you lose a thing that's so useful?
So for there to be selection for the penis to go away, there's got to be a very important reason.
What's the reason?
Well, there's a few possibilities. Number one,
people have speculated, for example, that there might have been sexually transmitted diseases. You're putting this penis way deep into the female, and then you're pulling your penis back into your cloaca. Like, there could be potentially a very easy exchange of sexually transmitted diseases.
Because you're, like, digging the germs deeper, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah.
So even though the penis has its advantages, obviously, maybe it slowly went away because the birds that had the penises just kept getting these infections.
That could be.
But so far, nobody's found a link between penises and STDs.
So then the other possibility that's really intriguing, actually, is that maybe it's because penises are heavy. And birds have started flying, and getting rid of the penis would have been an easy thing for lowering your body weight.
Maybe they lost them so they could fly further.
But I don't believe that. I mean, I think that's unlikely to have been a strong enough selection because ducks, for example, are among the most long-distance migrants, and they still have penises.
They're in the 3%.
And sometimes they have penises that are bigger than their own bodies. So
they do?
Oh, my God.
They do, yes.
You mean you watch a penis go by with wings, kind of?
Pretty much.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so I think the record is a male that had a 43-centimeter-long penis. And this is a male that was only about 40 centimeters long himself.
So apparently you can have a pretty large penis and fly just fine. But oddly enough, the ducks are also sort of a key to a third theory for the disappearance of the penis.
Well, yeah. So I was going to say my favorite is this idea that actually it had to do with female choice against males that control reproduction.
To explain, Patty actually thinks that the original bird penises,
back when they had penises,
might have been a lot like the modern day duck penis, which is essentially a weapon.
And so one of the things that we learned when we were studying the ducks is that the males have evolved this erection mechanism that is crazy. They have an explosive erection mechanism. What that means is that the male actually averts his penis and ejaculates in a third of a second.
Basically a pistol penis? Like a
exactly.
Pew.
Yeah. Yeah. It just goes pachoing. Yes.
Wow.
What that does, though, is that it allows these males to forcefully inseminate females, even when females don't want to be inseminated, right? So if this male is anywhere near a female, he's just going to go, you know, push right through. And so as you can imagine, that's not something necessarily desirable for females. Oftentimes with females will be struggling, right? They're trying to get away from these males that are trying to forcibly copulate.
So Patty thinks that what might have happened here is that female birds trying to get away from males with large penises and these really violent ways of approaching reproduction began systematically choosing gentler and smaller males with smaller penises.
Right. So if females start selecting males that are less violent, less sexually violent, that might lead to the disappearance of the penis.
What I think you just said is over time, because the ladies were discomforted, the gentlemen changed and lost their penises.
Yeah, you got it.
She's saying that the females essentially castrated the males?
Well, this is a slower process than that.
I mean, over time.
Over time, castration over time.
Yeah.
Yes, I suppose. Now, what evidence is there for such a thing?
So none, in a way, because we're talking about penises, which are soft tissue, and they don't fossilize. So even if we went back into the fossil record, it would be really hard to find evidence of what was happening. So that's the part that is difficult. You know, it's kind of like a wonderful story that that I think makes a lot of sense given what we know about the way these penises work now. But we can only speculate.
I like this idea.
Good.
But is this just a one-off? I mean, what about gorillas and moose who fight and clash their horns? I mean, there are so many species where it just seems like the females have zero choice.
So I know that there are a lot of cases like that. Bed bugs are especially horrifying.
Horrible.
Just Google it.
Oh my God, don't even talk about bed bugs.
But there are actually a lot of cases where when the females do get to choose, they choose in ways that completely change what we see in nature.
And we found a group of scientists who now argue that if you look around nature, you will see females driving evolution in ways that I certainly didn't expect. And when they get into the details of how this actually works, I think it's going to flip your ideas about evolution in a way that you are totally unprepared for.
Do they have evidence for this idea? Because I got to say that you haven't yet convinced me of the first thing they said, that females have evolved the penises away. Like I still
well, because yeah, that was a guess. Patty said it
was
a
guessing.
Guess.
Yeah,
fair enough. I will introduce you to a bird called a bowerbird that I think will. Well, it speaks for itself in these regards.
And it's also penisless.
They are really cool birds. they have beautiful plumage. The satin bowerbird is a beautiful iridescent blue with a violet blue eyes.
This is Gail.
Gail Patricelli, and I'm a professor of evolution and ecology at UC Davis. Do I want to say that again without stuttering on and?
No, it's fine. Anyway, so the bowerbird?
What makes them most amazing is that they build bowers.
So a bower, these things a bird spilled, is basically a structure made out of sticks, which can be up to 3 feet tall. And
3 feet tall?
Yeah. This tiny little bird making this.
You can put a 5-year-old in it in some of these things.
Wow.
Yeah, and it looks like a nest.
But it's really a kind of seduction theater. With one seat, and that's for her.
This is Richard Prum of Yale University. He's a biologist there, and he says that on and around this bower,
the male will array a whole bunch of found objects.
Precious objects.
Beautiful things.
Parrot feathers and berries and flowers and leaves.
Stuff that the bird gathers from the forest. So these structures can be very ornamented and elaborate.
And every bowerbird species has its own, like, style.
In some species, it'll all be blue everything. Blue feathers, blue flowers, and then, of course, blue trash, like drinking straws and bottle caps.
And the male bowerbird basically dedicates his whole life learning how to build these structures. Like, take the satin bowerbird.
They take 7 years before they reach sexual maturity. And during that period of time, they look just like females. And they'll often fly around the valley and get courted by adult males. So they play the role of the female and learn how courtship works from other males in the valley. And then when they get a little older, as teenagers, they'll start building practice bowers and they'll court each other.
And eventually, once a bowerbird figures out how to make a really good structure,
a female has arrived.
Females show up.
And so they'll fly down to the bower, and they'll often check out the bower itself. Is it symmetrical? Is it well-built?
She seems interested.
And if she likes what she sees, she'll enter the bower.
Now, this is where things get interesting, because the bower has a very particular and purposeful architecture.
So one of the classic bower designs is called an avenue bower. So it's two parallel walls of sticks. That are close to one another, and the female sits between them.
There are different variations on this basic design, but
in all cases, the female is in a protected position.
There's always some kind of barrier or wall between her and the male.
So the male wants to try to force himself on her for whatever reason. He has to run around the back, and she can just fly away out the front.
Even as he's trying to win her attention completely, he's built a building that keeps her at a distance?
Absolutely. The bower is like insurance against date rape for the female. It allows the female to observe him at an intimate close distance for as long as she likes, while still maintaining her freedom of choice.
So the female, if she likes the bower, she'll settle into this protected space where she can back out whenever she likes. And then?
Time to begin the show.
So he'll start out with his own displays.
Many of them make very loud electronical sounds.
Buzzing and whirring sounds.
And they do imitations of kookaburra, you know.
Sometimes they imitate cockatoos. Then, along with singing, they dance.
They puff up and they run vigorously back and forth right in front of the female. And she's standing between the walls of the bower.
So the female watches all of this from her safe spot for as long as she likes. And she can decide if she would like to mate with this guy or...
No, not good enough.
Up and fly away all of a sudden.
For the female, the moment has gone.
Now, what's particularly interesting here is that Gale has done studies that show when the males pay very close attention to the female.
Like when the male really watches her body position, the way that she's like postured, that can actually signal whether she's interested or not.
The males that respond the most to those signals are the most successful in mating.
In other words, if the male makes his move too early and too aggressively, she's gone. And that male doesn't have any babies.
Huh.
But it also seems like the females are kind of toying with the males, like seeing what they're willing to do for them. Like, if you watch a video of this, you can see in one bowerbird, she comes in, he like lifts up his wing like a cape, uh-huh. and then just like sort of rotates his wing like this. Like, it's so funny.
Oh, like a matador,
like
kind of?
Like a matador, totally like a matador. And then right after that, she like picks up a blueberry from the ground, uh-huh. and then she drops the blueberry, and then he does the matador thing with the blueberry in his mouth.
Like he has a rose in his mouth.
That's hilarious. She's like, you know, it's all right. But
this is good, but like...
You'd be so much better with this.
So it seems to be all about her.
I see what you mean in this case. Yeah, the females are definitely driving the bus here.
And when you start to really think about the implications of this, about it being all about her, that can lead you to a fairly deep rethink of the very basic rules of how evolution works.
Really? Meaning what?
Well, normally, the classical argument, and you've heard it, like the reason this male bird is so colorful, so red or whatever, the reason the peacock has these gigantic and beautiful feathers on its tail is sort of a signal that the male is sending to the female of fitness. Look at me. I am healthy to have a tail like this. I don't have parasites. I'm strong. I'd be a great mate.
Like survival of the fittest.
Right.
But let me ask you, you just heard the bowerbird story. You have these females with these crazy tastes. Like this one likes blue, only blue. And this one likes iridescent shells. So it's shells, 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 shells. And this one likes green leaves, but they have to be right side up and never right, you know, upside down. Are these fitness signals, or is this more like art? Maybe she just likes blue, or she just likes shells.
Wait, you're saying that these birds have evolved based on whims and tastes?
Well, Rick, and there's other scientists like him, say...
Absolutely.
Yes, it's about beauty.
I'm really focusing in on aesthetic choices, choices that are based on what it is the animal likes.
Wait, I thought the whole Darwinian thought was, well, yeah, okay, there might be beauty there, but on some level, the logic behind those beautiful things is survival of the fittest. This does not sound very Darwinian.
Well,
since you dropped the name.
I propose that my view is the legitimately, authentically Darwinian view.
Darwin, he had an idea about beauty?
Oh, yes. He actually...
You want to read the quote?
Did I bring it here?
Yeah, you brought it. Yeah.
Okay. Page 397, Descent of Man. Stripes and marks and ornamental appendages have all been indirectly gained through the influence of love, jealousy, through the appreciation of the beautiful, and through the exertion of a choice. Oh, interesting. So he's saying that it's love, jealousy, and beauty, and choice.
Yeah, and choice.
Yeah, that is definitely not what I learned when I learned about Darwin.
So it's over 130 years later, and I'm still pissed.
He thinks there was some kind of plot to reduce Darwin's idea into something smaller and eventually eliminated entirely.
I would like to go historical. Let's go about what Darwin said.
Okay.
Let's go what Wallace said, and then let's go to the 20th century and where we got so screwed up.
Okay. So Darwin spent 20 years working on his theory of natural selection. He was not particularly noisy about it because he knew it would very much disturb his wife, who was quite religious, and other people in his church. So during the 20 years while Darwin was working away at his book, this other guy comes on the scene. His name is Alfred Russel Wallace. Kind of skinny and scrappy and self-taught, 14 years younger than Charles Darwin. But Wallace also
went around the world collecting specimens.
And he also came up with a theory of natural selection independently.
What was their relationship to each other? I mean, did they were they friends? Were they collaborators? Were they...
Well, you know, they were close collaborators.
At first, they kind of both got credit for the idea. But a little later...
Darwin rocketed out his book into press.
When he published his On the Origin of Species, a very popular book.
Darwin got the lion's share of the credit, as I think rightly so, because he'd been working on the idea for literally for decades.
Then 20 years later, Darwin dies. Meanwhile, Wallace
lived until the dawn of World War I.
And during that time, this is Rick's argument, after Darwin died, Wallace kept saying over and over and over again that when it came to female choice,
animals didn't have the sensory and cognitive capacity to make aesthetic judgments in nature.
So these elaborate decorations and artistic behaviors
could only evolve if it communicates information about vigor, quality, and general fitness to survive.
And Rick would say that because Darwin wasn't around to argue back,
Wallace may have lost the battle over credit for the discovery of adaptation by natural selection, but he won the war over what evolutionary biology would become in the 20th century. We have inherited both the science and the culture, a flattened, dumbed down, and ideologically purified version of Darwin's actual richness.
Whoa, those are fighting words.
Well, you see, Rick is pretty fired up about this, and he's written a book, Evolution of Beauty, where he argues that ever since Alfred Russel Wallace, scientists have been trying to squeeze everything they see in these male patterns, male dances, male songs, male plumages, into a single explanation, a dogmatic category called fitness, and that female choice, they claim, is always, always about fitness, fitness, fitness. But Rick argues, no, you know, that's a stretch. There's no way to boil down all this variety into fitness.
I'm not saying that the emperor wears no clothes. I'm saying that the emperor is wearing a loincloth. And what I mean by that is that humble garment covers about the same percentage of the human body as the idea of adaptive mate choice covers all the ornaments of sexual ornaments
oh
in the world.
Oh, my God. What you just said is that most of what you see...
Vast majority.
So most of what you see in the world you think is the desire between creatures expressed in beautiful form.
Absolutely. And that
not a fitness, not that, oh, that she's just looking at him thinking he's strong, he's genetically trustworthy. None of those. Just, I love him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so wait, he's saying most of the time when you see the ornaments, that's not fitness at all, that's beauty?
Yeah,
that's
most.
What he says.
Most.
Yeah.
He's big time on most.
Well, how would you even... know that? I mean, as a human, how would you ever even know the inner workings of another creature's mind to know enough to say what it is that's driving them or not?
I asked this very question to ornithologist Kim Boswick.
Right.
Isn't it impossible for you as a human being to have any idea what a lady animal wants to see in a guy if that lady animal is a peahen, which you aren't, or a trout, which you aren't.
I'm ready to answer this. I mean, here it is. I don't know what she wants now, but I know historically she's wanted exactly what you see in those males. The peahen has wanted that big old tail. She's wanted the show.
She's wanted the blue chest. She has, at some time or another in the last, I don't know how many thousands of years, she has wanted everything you see on him, from the fancy feathers to the white skin around his eye to the iridescent blue, the shaking. That's what she has wanted in the past.
How do you know that?
Because it's there. Now, seriously.
Isn't there some lawyer in the room who could say, wait a second, is that it? What do you mean, because it's there?
How else did it get there? Well, how else did it get there?
Well, it could have gotten there by accident.
Chance?
Yes.
Yeah. So you just happen to have this, like, fine nanostructured iridescent colors in your feather because, like, 42 interacting genes across 5 different chromosomes came together to give you iridescent blue? No.
The way you get to iridescent blue, says Kim, is you start small.
You give your female a bunch of choices, which are the males in her block.
So imagine a female bird surrounded by a bunch of males who are all just boring or gray or black or whatever, then totally randomly, a male shows up who just happens to have a little bit of blue on him. And she notices.
When the sun glints off of his black plumage, there's just a little hint of blue in that black. It's kind of a glossy, shiny blue-black. And she's like, I like that. I like that. That is a little different than everybody else, and I like it.
And who knows why, it could be totally random too, but for whatever reason, she decides to mate with the blue guy.
I like that.
And because she's passing on his genes, her sons are likely going to be a little bit blue too.
Her offspring are going to have those beautiful genes, and we already know that the females chose him because he was attractive, and so she's going to have attractive sons, and her daughters are going to also find those traits attractive.
And so what you get are generations and generations of females who say,
I like that. I like that. And then off it goes. You're creating, you're evolving the males to please the females.
And it all starts with,
I like that.
But I like that doesn't feel to me opposite of fitness. Like, I like that could be a desire that is driven by instinct. I mean, couldn't like a Wallace person walk in and be like, yeah, she likes that because she was designed to like that. She's not thinking about the why there. She's just having a desire. But behind that desire is maybe a drive to get her to the male that is the fittest. Like, and frankly, it could be the same with us too, with people. Like, what we find sexy might have a deep logic to it.
Yeah, I see that.
Maybe in the end is about fitness.
Okay, that's a perfectly reasonable objection. But,
thank you.
But what if I told you about an animal who has a fierce desire for beauty, and this particular desire for beauty is so strong that fitness is out of the picture?
It's another bird.
Big surprise, bird. I know. Don't hate them because they're beautiful, Jad. Jeez. We'll just take a break. We'll take a break, and afterward, we'll come back with a third bird.
Radiolab is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. If you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order, because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply. Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon/not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you, either way, for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out, and thanks.
Jad.
Robert.
Bethel.
Radiolab.
We're back mid-battle between beauty and fitness.
Bird battle.
Bird battle, and we're about to introduce our third bird.
Yeah, you want me to go?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, okay. So there's a bird out there called the club-winged mannequin. And this mannequin lives in the jungles of, I forgot where she was, somewhere in the jungles.
South America.
In South America, that's true. It's probably, I think, Colombia.
Well, okay, so the club-winged mannequin has a very small range in Colombia and Ecuador.
Is it a big bird, small
no,
bird?
No, very little.
It's a tiny bird. The males are mostly red.
He's got a bright red head.
Kind of an auburn body and black and white wings with little flecks of yellow underneath them. So these are small birds, lots of color. And
the female can raise the babies all on her own.
Oh, so she doesn't need guys except for the sexual act.
Right.
He doesn't have to provide for her. He just has to attract her. So, to that end, this is what our little red Romeo will do. He'll sit on a branch in the Andean jungle, and he'll wait a while until a female shows up. And then when she does,
he has a courtship display, and he bounces back and forth on the perch. And while he's bouncing around,
every so often he stops, lowers his head, sticks his butt up in the air,
gets his wings all positioned, and he throws them up
behind his back.
And then he vibrates, or just shivers. He shivers his wings together so that the only things that touch are those feathers across the back. The tips of those funny feathers are going knock, 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 knock. They knock 39 times in a row, and it takes about a third of a second for those 39 knocks.
Their wings vibrate so fast that they make this sound.
Can you make the sound that he makes?
Whoa!
It's impossible for a human to make with their voice.
Is that seriously the sound it makes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a truck backing up.
Exactly, yeah.
So he's not using his voice for that? It's just his wings?
He's got this instrument.
Yeah, it's called stridulation. So this is a cricket-winged mannequin would be a perfectly good name for this bird.
In any case, something about that sound, that specific sound, excites the female. We don't know why or when it started, but somewhere in the bird's past, a female decided she liked that sound, and so the males just started to make it. But here's the thing. In order to make that sound...
Yeah, they really have paid. They have paid.
Because to vibrate your wings that fast, 107 times per second, you need a rigid wing bone that you can really control. And so the club-winged mannequin has done something unheard of. Their wing bones went solid.
It's just like a rock inside there.
This is a big deal because all flying birds have hollow wing bones.
Right, so they can fly. So
yeah, well, actually, even Velociraptor and T-Rex have hollow forelimb bones, right? So this is a feature that predates the origin of birds and the origin of flight. But this guy has given this up in order to make these extraordinary wing songs.
Well, doesn't that hurt your ability to fly?
Yes, yes. They are slow, heavy, unable to leap buildings in a single bound.
It's the cost of doing business for a displaying male, right?
Think about that. You're in a crowded forest, lots of competitors, lots of predators trying to eat you, and you have made yourself slower, more vulnerable. And it gets worse, because the mannequins have to start this process of building these hard bones really early, like when they're very, very tiny in the embryo.
Before the embryo has become either male or female.
So you've got an embryo that can go either way, and they're already making the big bones, and some of them are going to be male, but some of them are going to be female.
So by choosing males with weird wing bones because they make great songs, the female also has daughters with distorted and inferior wing bones that they will never use.
Both the females and the males get these thick bones. So she is choosing to hear that sound and has designed him to produce that sound. But in the bargain, he comes out with heavier bones and can fly less well. And weirdly enough, she comes out with heavier bones and can fly less well. So both of them are hurting their chances to survive for the chance to hear the beautiful tone that she wants to hear and that he wants to give her.
What? Wait, so she has heavy bones too?
Yeah. Yep.
But she doesn't use them?
Nope.
Well.
Rick saw it immediately. Like, I was like, oh, this is weird. The female's got the bumps on her bones too. And he's like, oh, decadence. And I was like, what? What are you talking about, decadence? He's like, the females have it, but they don't use it. She's bearing the cost of her own choices, decadence. And this was like 20 years ago.
You science people have such strange moments of ecstasy. So when he said decadence, what did he mean?
So everybody in the population becomes worse off because females are so choosy and choose beauty.
So from Rick's point of view, you've got a contest going on here. Two primal drives. And on one hand, there's the desire to survive. Survival of the fittest, right? And according to that logic, the mannequin should go for the things that make him swift and powerful and agile. But on the other hand, there's a second drive to see, or in this case, to hear something they like, something beautiful. And in this case, that second drive is so strong that it's winning. It's pushing the birds like away from fitness.
So we've gone through the math, and others have as well. And there is nothing, in theory, nothing to prevent this kind of process from leading to extinction.
Oh my God!
Right?
So you've just just turned what I normally think of as Darwinian evolution on its head. Like, we've always been taught that what these animals are doing is they're adapting as best as they can to new and changing conditions, and they're getting better. But here you say that they are so hung up on desire and beauty that they even are willing to get worse.
Right. Well, you know, that's why this example is checkmate.
But there are biologists.
Eminent biologists.
Hello?
You don't want to be sucking a lollipop or whatever you're doing there, Jerry.
Like Jerry Coyne of the University of Chicago.
I'll be through with it when I go on the air.
Who disagree with Rick? What is it? Is it a lollipop or?
No, it's a cough drop.
Oh, it's a cough drop. Okay. So Jerry read Rick's book and is not convinced by his argument.
Well, I think it's a good book, but it's not a great book. It's good because it has really great stories about mating behavior, which are accurate stories, as far as I know, and they're quite absorbing. Prum is a good writer. The reason it's not a great book is that it's tendentious. That is, it's written to promote a cause.
Which is, of course, that males with beautiful ornaments are shaped by female sense of beauty, not fitness.
I think that the word fitness is a huge problem, and I don't use it anymore.
That you can't just say that and have it accepted by scientists unless you can test it. Okay. And that is the problem.
For Jerry, when it comes to the stories that we just heard, like the bowerbird or the mannequin, he thinks that
more is going on here than what Richard says in his book, you know.
Take the female bowerbird's preference for bowers that keep her apart from males.
I mean, Richard's explanation that it allows the female more time to choose, it doesn't freak her out because she feels protected. That might be the right explanation. But we don't know. I mean, it could be that females have an innate preference for being sheltered because it gives them a sense of security. She like cats. Cats like to be in boxes, right? Because they feel sheltered and they feel safe. And it could be that female bowerbirds are the same way. And that will lead to exactly the same situation, but with a completely different explanation. And it's not just a random aesthetic phenomenon.
Or he says maybe some female bowerbirds like blue so much because blueberries are really good for them, and they're innately drawn to blue because of that.
Or that, let go to the mannequin tail with that, you know, 1500 hertz tone. Rick says that simply delights the females, but...
Suppose that the females prefer males that have a certain frequency of wing beating because they were attuned to that frequency, perhaps because it indicates something in their environment that's useful to them, like the presence of a predator. Or they just
could be anything, really. Sound of some, you know, mannequin-friendly animal or a protective animal, or maybe the call of their own babies, the baby chicks.
And so they just have their nervous system innately tuned to that frequency. That's called sensory bias, and that's another theory of sexual selection. So they
Jerry doesn't dispute the fact that female birds like bowers. They do. Or that they like a beautiful tone. They do. He just thinks that there might be a reason behind their liking, and that reason could include fitness.
Correct, yeah.
Are you hoping, I guess, is that the right word? Hoping that there might be a parasite signal involved here? Like, you don't know. You just want to
keep... No, I don't know. I mean, that's my whole point. And that's why I don't propose my own theory of sexual selection. I'm not sure which one does account for these mannequins with the heavy bones. We just don't know.
Oh, my God. So, this conversation we're having keeps ending up in the same place, which is we just don't know.
Well, but the difference between me and Dr. Prom is I admit I don't know.
The suggestion here is that Rick is clinging to a faith in one explanation. For Wallace, it was fitness. For Rick, it's beauty. But it's still that dogmatic insistence.
I just think that adaptation by natural selection is pretty boring. You know, we've, you know, 150 years in, we've whipped that pony quite a bit, and we've made a whole bunch of progress. But you know what? There's this huge world of opportunity in aesthetic evolution that has been missed.
In fact, Rick would say, the whole point of a sense of beauty is it can be many, many different things. Beauty is fundamentally subjective.
So the aesthetic model requires that we put the subjective experience, desire itself, at the center of our scientific explanation.
But can you even have a science that's based on subjective experience?
I think that a science of subjective experience is not only a good idea, it's necessary to understand the natural world.
Yeah. There is idiosyncrasy.
Again, ornithologist Kim Bostwick.
You can't take the individuals out of it.
So you don't... Is that science, or is that just saying, okay, it really comes down to... She, the carp, likes what that male carp has. She, the worm, likes what the worm has. She, the bird, likes what the bird has. And then you have a trillion explanations, each one different, and depending upon the lady, a different one. So you don't... Doesn't it worry you that to call beauty and desire a category of an explanation is to not tell you very much?
That doesn't worry me at all. All of us, we are individuals. We have unique histories. And life on this planet has a unique history. Science has a hard time dealing with unique instances. But biology is just in your face with it. There are individual females making choices. If that individual female had not made that choice, history might have been different and the species might look different. Wow. And that is true. That's just true.
In physics and in chemistry, there's this sort of conceit that what a scientist is supposed to do is take all this variety that you see in front of you and say, look, I can boil this down to a rule, which is always true.
Yeah,
and usually it's one rule and
transcends. Yeah, transcends everything.
So what the job of science usually is to find some kind of oneness inside the manyness. But now we've got nature and living things, and they have this crazy, spectacular variety. And now you've got a group of people who say, you know, maybe we shouldn't even try to explain all this. with one rule or one paradigm. But, you know, I wonder if that's still science or is it more like history? What if every species or every animal comes with its own story?
That's interesting.
So it's once upon a time, and then a once upon a time, and 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 a once upon a time.
Coming up, Once Upon a Time with Bats. Radiolab will continue in a moment.
Hey, this is Becca. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas to let you know that Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
This is Radiolab, and our last story was all about birds.
Yeah, it was about birds. Surprising birds, because they were choosing their mates for their beauty instead of for their fitness, right?
Because they were beautiful.
Yeah.
And for no other reason.
Well, in this next segment, we're going to do it again. We're going to challenge our understanding of evolution, and this time we're
going to
do
it. This time we're going to do it with some bats.
But friendly bats.
That you could argue are selfless.
Oftentimes, what you would call nice behavior is actually disguised selfishness, as critters of one kind or another try to push their genes into the future by being nice to particular folks, to their sisters,
to their cousins, mothers and fathers.
Yeah. Yes, to those who are from their family, which share so many of their genes.
Like according to some, like a real hard-ass biologist could argue, if you're nice to your sister, you're really just being nice to your own genes in another person's body. We were like, come on.
Yeah.
Is there another way of thinking about this?
And so we met a guy.
Yes. My name's Jerry Wilkinson. I'm a professor and chair of the Department of Biology at the University of Maryland, College Park.
And the story that Jerry told us happened way before he was a chair or anything like that.
Yes.
Back when he was a lowly grad student.
The first summer of my graduate education, I went to Costa Rica.
This was the summer of 1977.
We went all over the country, we've studied various things, and we had an opportunity to apply for money to stay in Costa Rica and do individual projects.
And Jerry decided what he was going to study were bats.
Right.
Now, why bats? Have you always liked bats?
I never actually handled a bat before I went to Costa Rica, so I had no prior experience whatsoever, and I was, like anyone, I think maybe a little bit hesitant, I guess.
But he says he just happened to be in this place that had a lot of bats.
Because I was on a cattle ranch.
Otherwise known as the McDonald's of bats.
Yes.
Because there's something we haven't told you here. These were
vampire bats. The common vampire bat, which feeds primarily on mammalian blood.
And these particular bats, Jerry says, lived down by the river.
In hollow trees.
Big ones.
Inside, they were like caves.
The trees along the rivers.
And every night, he says,
hundreds of these bats would fly out of their trees, kind of like a cloud, and move across the fields, heading towards
run, cows!
A herd of cows.
basically they will hop up onto a cow,
sink their teeth,
razor sharp teeth,
into the cow's neck and start
sucking its blood.
And in a matter of about a half an hour, they basically swell up like a big tick.
And fly home to the tree.
Quickly. Then they come back to the trees.
Anyhow, what Jerry was really interested in was not so much the cow blood-sucking thing. It was how do the bats behave with each other?
Yeah.
So one morning he went down to the river where these bats live, found himself a tree.
These trees, some of them were so big that I could actually lie down inside the tree without bending my knees. We would use binoculars to look up at the top of the cavity, which could be anywhere from 15 feet to 40 feet above the ground.
Now picture this. You're in this tree. It's four stories high. It's dark, it's wet, and up at the top.
How many are up there?
Maybe 20 would be sort of some of the larger groups.
What about poop? Weren't they pooping on you? Because you're right in the direct line.
Yes, they do that. And it's sort of like tar when they defecate blood. It's very sticky.
But day after day, he would go into these trees, get pooped on, and watch them. And pretty soon he starts to notice that these bats are behaving in ways he didn't expect.
They behave quite a bit like primates.
Meaning what?
They spend a lot of time grooming each other.
Really?
30% of the time in the trees, they spend grooming each other.
Wow. So there you were looking at these reputedly evil creatures and seeing them kind of snuggle. I mean, were you surprised by this?
Oh, yeah. Took me no time at all to become very fond, I guess would be the best way to describe it. They are very social. They're very interactive.
But then Jerry saw one of the bats do something.
That went way beyond just being social.
You know, it's hard to say. It certainly was not a single observation.
But basically, here's how it would go. One bat
will sort of sidle up to another bat and
give her a little hug.
They sort of clutch each other with their wings, which are folded up.
And then the bat that made the move, it came up and gave the hug. You'd see that bat
try to lick at the mouth of
the other bat, the one it's hugging.
And if you have a good view, you can actually see the tongue of one bat going into the mouth of the other bat.
Like they're giving each other a kiss?
Very similar, yes.
But after seeing this a few times, he realized what really was happening is that the one bat was feeding the other bat.
Yes.
Giving it a meal.
By regurgitating blood.
Into the other bat's mouth.
And that was a shock.
A shock because, these weren't moms feeding their babies. I mean, that we've all seen. And that makes sense. No, these were adult animals.
Feeding other adult animals.
Food that they could have been eating themselves.
Right.
Which is weird.
That had not been described before.
But then he thought, wait a second. I know what's going on here.
What?
These bats, they're just related.
Correct.
They're relatives.
Close relatives.
Yeah.
The idea that was in vogue then and is still in vogue now, and certainly it's actually got much more support now than it did then, is that animals tend to help close relatives and sort of never help anybody who's not a close relative.
So we thought that must be it. They're related.
But you don't just assume it. You must test it if you're a scientist. So Jerry said, okay, I'm going to check this out. I'm going to set up a little experiment.
Yeah, so he went out and got a bunch of bats that he knew were not related.
I think I had two groups of six, total of 12 bats. Brought them into my house at the time, went to the slaughterhouse, got a lot of blood. And then every night I would take one of the 12 bats out of the cage and not let it feed while everybody else got access to blood.
Which means this sad little bat gets no dinner but has to watch the others eat, and it's just getting
hungrier and hungrier.
Well, how long can a bat go with no blood?
3 days at most.
At most.
And then they're dead.
So you can imagine that by the time the sun rises, this bat is literally starving.
And then at dawn, I would put the female back in who hadn't fed. She will go and beg,
please,
from other individuals.
Please.
And
weirdly, instead of them saying to her,
you're not my sister, bug off.
Yeah, according to Jerry, what would happen is that they'd
hold still, part their lips, and
throw up in her mouth.
Thank you.
I mean, at that point, I was thrilled that I had found something that seemed to indicate that it wasn't just all about relatedness.
But just to make sure this wasn't a fluke?
What I then did over the span of the next 2 weeks is I continued to take one bat out of the cage every night.
And he'd do the whole starve her till dawn thing and then put her back in the cage with the others.
And she was always fed by someone from her group, and occasionally even by more than one individual from her group.
Sometimes one bat would step up and say, okay, here, have something, and then maybe another, sometimes a third, and he thought, I wonder what's going on here. Is this random, or is there some kind of system? He just couldn't really tell.
So then I just kept track of who fed whom. While I was there, I was, you know, staying up all night. I wasn't really doing a lot of analysis of the information, and I was only there for a relatively short period. I got back up to San Diego.
Did the analysis.
And discovered that
there appeared to be a pattern.
If, you know, Sally fed Agnes on the first day, and then I later starved Sally, then Agnes fed Sally
on the second night.
Right.
Let's just go through this one more time. If on the first day
Sally fed Agnes,
then on the second day
Agnes fed Sally invariably. Not always, but invariably. And much.
What does invariably mean in that? Most of the time?
Most of the time. Most of the time.
So if I'm Agnes, I'm only going to feed Sally
under the condition that at some later point in time,
she
will repay the favor.
I feed you.
You feed me.
Agnes feeds Sally. Sally feeds Agnes.
And if you think about it, this is kind of what friendship is. I mean, we never say that explicitly, but friendship works on these kinds of traits.
And Mindy feeds Cindy.
Cindy feeds Mindy.
Invariably.
In fact, with the bats, Jerry, at a certain point, created a kind of matrix that plotted
who had spent time with whom.
The friendships between the individual bats.
And that allowed me to actually calculate a number that measured, you know, who was the best friends and who were the not such good friends.
Like a friend number?
Yes.
Oh, this is so eighth grade.
And it turns out that number is the best predictor of who will feed whom. It's better than who's related to whom.
Better?
Yes. Although it turned out that they both were important. So
yeah, but I want to write a headline around this. You're saying that that buddies beat kin.
Yes. Yes.
Think of what this means. If friends can beat family, then first of all, friends are people that you choose.
Yeah, I mean, you've stuck with your family, but you can choose your friends.
So this is, in effect, an idea that niceness is really deeply chosen.
Yeah.
Well, so what is in the broad scientific community, does this mean that what you counted and saw open up altogether again the question of who helps who and why?
Yes, but now we're talking 1984. That's when this work was published, and that's when the sort of, and I gave talks about it various places, so it became well known pretty quickly. And
it was a really big deal. In fact, some scientists thought maybe this is going to revolutionize our whole understanding of niceness and nature and social dynamics and creatures, because, you know, maybe this behavior isn't just a bat thing, it's everywhere. And we just haven't been seeing it. We haven't been working hard enough to see it. Like this Jerry guy slept in a tree, got pooped on for weeks on end. Maybe if we pushed ourselves that far, we'd find this all over the place. But
no.
Didn't work out that way.
There are not many convincing cases that I think people identified in those next few years.
So the observation you're making may not be writ large, just may be writ small?
I'm not sure I would describe it exactly that way, but clearly it's how much we can extrapolate the vampire bat story to other systems is an open question. And
well, in your most extrapolative frame of mind, maybe when you're sitting in a bar and you're three martinis in, and in your gut, in your drunk gut at that moment, what is your hunch? Is this a representative case and we just haven't found it elsewhere, but we will? Or is this a one-off?
Oh, I don't think it's unique, but I don't think it's very common. Mm-hmm. I think it would be quite uncommon. You know, vampire bats are really pretty special because of this reliance on blood.
Here's one story you could tell, says Jerry. Way back in the day.
40,000 or more years in the past.
The plains where the bats lived were filled with all of these giant creatures.
Big mammals were abundant.
Saber-toothed tigers,
yeah.
Mammoths.
Wolves and giant sloths. Mm.
And all of these things were filled with warm blood, so the bats were very happy.
But
presumably, there was a point in time when all of these large mammals disappeared.
Really fast. And there are all kinds of theories as to why that happened. The point is,
it must have created a time when vampire bats all of a sudden had a hard time finding prey. At that point, I would think it would have been behoove a vampire bat to come up with some way to deal with periodic food shortages.
And he thinks the strategy they came up with somehow, was to share.
If they didn't help each other, I think you would find vampire bats gone. I mean, we wouldn't see them now.
Well, this is interesting. This is a new way to explore the question we've been exploring all this time.
Yeah, like, why is there niceness in the world?
Yeah. Now, up to now, we thought, well, mostly niceness is a secret form of
selfishness.
Selfishness, you know,
like, yeah. Selfishness
get
dressed up.
Get your genes into the future, yeah.
Yeah.
But this is a different version. This one says, you know, under certain circumstances for a group of animals, being nice really isn't an option. It's
the only way.
Yeah.
Like when the going gets tough, the tough get nice.
Nice.
How's that for a bumper sticker?
Hi, my name is Kim Euker, and I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I'm a Radiolab listener. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org. Thank you very much.
End of message.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.